Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Open the morning paper, turn on the TV, the radio, log on. Today's news is fast-paced and politically high-pitched. Some argue that opinion has taken over the American media. Victor Novasky, publisher of The Nation, says hold on, that's just attitude, and mainstream attitude at that. The country's slender opinion journals, right and left, are the last real truth-tellers, he says, on a media landscape increasingly controlled by big business. Tonight on Point, dissent, debate, and opinion in American journalism today with Victor Novasky. But first, we begin tonight in Washington with reaction to the Justice Department's surprise announcement today in its case against the tobacco industry that it will seek less than 8%, or just $10 billion, of the $130 billion a government expert said should be sought to offset years of smoking promotion by big tobacco. Anti-smoking activists and the judge in the case are asking what's behind the decision. Carol Leonig is covering the story for The Washington Post and joins me now. Carol, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure, thank you.
That's quite a drop from $130 billion that they were seeking to $10 billion. Has there been a rationale offered, Carol?
Well, quite a drop is right. In fact, there were a lot of dropped jaws that day in court yesterday when this was announced at the basically in the last 9 minutes of the closing arguments by the government. The rationale, surprisingly, was not immediately offered and still has not been offered. For 2 days, the Associate Attorney General overseeing the case and the Civil Division of the Justice Department has declined to answer reporters' questions about what was the reason for going from $130 billion a government expert recommended for smoking cessation programs to $10 billion instead.
You've got a landmark civil racketeering case here, a racketeering case against cigarette makers. It was when the case began in 2004, as you report, the government sought to force the tobacco industry to pay $280 billion in allegedly ill-gotten profits. Do you have any sense from your reporting of what happened here?
Well, there's a lot of speculation, gross and educated, going around the courtroom and the courthouse in the last 24 hours. But what I'm hearing from the more reliable sources is that the high-level Justice Department officials pressured the trial team to accept the lower number. The trial team, a bunch of career attorneys, said they thought they could defend the $130 billion. It's what their experts said. But that higher up echelon officials, political appointees, said no, they thought a lower number was more appropriate. What's interesting is that you may remember that in this case, the judge who's overseeing it had ordered the parties to consider settlement and to engage in at least perfunctory settlement talks.
Mm-hmm.
And during those settlement talks, sort of the high-level justice officials were meeting, you know, shoulder to shoulder with Philip Morris and RJR industry attorneys to talk with them about what would be acceptable to them. So some of the more educated speculation is that during those settlement talks, these were numbers that were bandied about as more acceptable.
Where did the $130 billion number come from, and what was that money supposed to be used for, Carol?
Well, the number came from the government's expert, and frankly, the nation's preeminent expert on smoking cessation. He chaired a Department of Health and Human Services panel on what the country nationwide could do for reducing smoking and helping people quit smoking. 45 million people in America smoke, 400,000 die each year from smoking-related illnesses, and of the 45 million smokers, estimated 30 million have indicated they want to quit. So Michael Fiore, a University of Wisconsin scientist, had postulated in great detail, comprehensive plan, all of the ways that you could help smokers quit. The most expensive things were a 24-hour helpline nationwide, an education campaign to let people know the helpline existed, a series of treatment programs, research for cessation to figure out what helps smokers quit the quickest and the easiest for a variety of reasons. And then also potentially free medications. The tobacco industry assailed these numbers as weak, unfounded, ridiculous, Martian. and they had the ear of the judge in the sense that the judge also raised questions. Well, Mr. Fiore, you know, Dr. Fiore, forgive me, exactly how can you justify this amount of money and tell me that we need that much? He said it would cost $5 billion every year for 25 years based on estimates that a certain percentage of people would take a long time to quit.
And now it will be much, much less than that, $10 billion over 5 years. The judge today saying, asking out loud, questioning whether additional influences had prompted the government to reduce that dollar amount. Might the judge step in to seek a larger amount, or is this simply a done deal? If that's what the Justice Department asked for, that's what they asked for.
I would never be so presumptuous as to suggest what this smart, thorough, careful judge might do in the future. But I know legally she has the power to say that these are the restrictions and the dollar penalty she recommends. So although the government has said, here's what we're requesting for cessation, the judge could order more if she chose.
Well,
it would be a little bit strange, but she could.
A stunning step down on the dollar amount sought from big tobacco companies today, but we'll be watching as the case goes forward. Carol, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Carol Leonig is staff writer for The Washington Post. She spoke with me from Washington. We're talking tonight about dissent and opinion in the American media today. Victor Navasky has lived the issue. In 1978, he became editor of The Nation, founded in 1865, the oldest opinion weekly in the country, and a bastion of liberal opinion. The story of his path to The Nation is a wonderful one. The story of his fight to keep it going is a life and death magazine drama. But the real story may be the endangered status of challenging opinion itself in America today. Navasky strongly believes that opinion journals like The Nation speak truth to power and encourage public discourse. Some media critics cite an overabundance of opinion in news media today with Crossfire, Al Franken, and conservative talk radio. But Navasky believes that mainstream media don't have the ability, editorial freedom, or the guts to frame the debate and inform their readers. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your take on opinion journals of the left and right today? Are they redundant with the high political attitude pouring over the nation's airwaves, or are they critical to serious debate? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Victor Navasky, publisher of The Nation and director of the Center for Magazine Journalism at Columbia University. He spent the last 27 years at the helm of The Nation one way or another. He's a former writer and editor at the New York Times Magazine, a former fellow and scholar at Harvard, Columbia, and Princeton Universities. His new book is A Matter of Opinion. Victor Navasky, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to be here, Tom.
Also with us is On Point News analyst with me in the studio tonight, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you right
here.
Hello,
Tom, and hello, Victor.
Hi, Jack.
So, Victor Navasky, you tell a big story. It's a life story, but it's got an opinion journal right at the heart of it. It's a terrific tale, and you came out surviving against the odds.
Well, it's not over yet, so don't make premature judgment. But we're actually, you know, for years at The Nation, we've had a very bad joke. People, we said, if it's bad for the country, it's good for the nation. So people ask now, how are you doing? I say, better than ever, better than ever.
And that, as I read the numbers here, is literally true. Since the election of President George W. Bush, you've got higher than ever circulation figures.
Yes. Well, when I got to The Nation in 1978, we had a our publisher told us we had 25,000, the fellow we bought it from, circulation. And when we got there, that was right, but he forgot to tell us that 7,500 of the paying subscribers hadn't been requested to renew.
Oops.
So their subscriptions had expired. And so we really had about 18,000 subscribers. The last time we were audited, a few months ago, we had a circulation of over 184,000.
How do you describe the politics of The Nation, Victor Navasky? I'm looking here, Howard Kurtz quoting you from the new, in your memoir, saying it's been called liberal, Leninist, Stalinist, anti-Semitic, Zionist? How do you describe its politics?
Troublemaking, dissenting journal. We're seeking the truth. We're on the left side of the political spectrum these days, but that's because the country has shifted all the way over to the right. And, you know, we're in the business of really trying to analyze and understand what's going on and to identify the critical issues through moral argument, political analysis, and we monitor the mainstream media. So it's a, you know, we have core values, but we don't have a party line.
Jack Beatty, no party line, Victor Novasky says, but opinion needed, opinion journals needed, this in an era of rather opinionated press work.
Yes, and it can be risky. I mean, when Herbert Crowley founded the New Republic, he said the purpose of the magazine was to promote little insurrections in the realm of our readers' convictions. But that's risky.
You know, I almost called my book, instead of A Matter of Opinion, I almost called it Little Insurrection.
There you go.
Well, you know, our friend and our mutual hero, Victor, I.F. Stone, talked to me about that, and he said, you know, you can, when you cross your readers in an opinion journal, you can really have trouble. He lost about half his readership in 1956, he told me, when he went to the Soviet Union and really described what was there. And then he lost another third or more when he defended the Warren Report. But he said, the truth, I had to tell the truth, and that was above what was convenient, what people wanted to hear. But that can be a tough thing for an opinion journal, because people want it more like they want a church. They don't want their insurrection in their convictions.
We'll look at exactly that. Victor Novasky is with us tonight. His new book is A Matter of Opinion. You can join us. What's your question for the longtime editor of one of the leading voices of the American left? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Victor Novasky, publisher of The Nation, about dissent, debate, and opinion in American journalism today. His new memoir is A Matter of Opinion. He joins us tonight from New York. Jack Beatty's with us as well. You can join us. What do you think? What's your question for the longtime editor of one of the leading voices of the American left? Are you a Nation reader? What's it give you that you don't get elsewhere? And are opinion journals of the left and right fighting for truth, or are they prisoners of interest groups, of ideology? How do you see it? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Victor Novasky, you write that the problem today is too little opinion, not too much. What do you say?
Yeah, you know, the president of ABC News gave a speech recently, and he wrote an article in Columbia Journalism Review where he said that opinion was driving out objectivity. And, you know, I had gone to the Democratic Convention in Boston, and I went to a presentation at the Kennedy School where someone got up and asked, all of the anchors were on the stage, the then anchors, Brokaw,
the big TV anchors, yeah.
And someone got up and he said, why is it that young people say they get their information, their news, from Jon Stewart? And all of the anchors had the same answer, because they're too stupid to understand the difference between satire and the real thing. Ooh. And I'm sitting there thinking, hey, just a minute. The reason that young people like Jon Stewart is, first of all, of course, because he's very funny, but secondly, because the anchors have this pretense of narrative neutrality, as if they had no politics of their own or no ideas or values of their own. Everything they put forward is supposed to be objective, whereas Stewart is always saying what he believes. He is fighting hypocrisy. And that's ultimately why he makes this connection with younger people. And I think that's ultimately the case for the sharing of your political values when you make your political arguments. That doesn't mean that, you know, there isn't room for daily journalism and all of that, but it means that there's a special value to having these journals that can, at considerable length, make very serious arguments, and they end up setting the standard for public discourse.
You describe the mainstream media today, maybe always, as a kind of prisoner of official news. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that they tend to internalize the values of the powers that be. So, for example, if the Secretary of State makes an announcement, that's news, and it gets on page one, depending on what he said or not. If it's they are, and they have formats that they follow that preclude the reporter from saying what he thinks about what's going on. And so what you get is what someone has called the stenographers to power, whether it's government power or corporate power. And what you get in these journals, on the other hand, is original argumentation and, if you know, at its best, the facts to back it up. And there's room for both in the world, but the difference is that the worst thing, you know, you said all those things that they call the Nation. The worst thing they can call us is ideological. And my view is that, yes, the Nation has the ideology these days of the liberal left. The National Review or the Weekly Standard has the ideology of the right. But the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the networks have the ideology of the center. And it is part of the ideology of the center to deny that it has an ideology. And whether that's because of a lack of self-awareness or a strategic posture, it's a very serious thing. And that's what informs what they think is important. That's what informs what they choose to cover. That's what informs the way they cover it. It's what informs what they put on page one, et cetera.
But when you pull the curtains back just a little wider, Victor Nevesky, you've got this teeming jungle of stuff. When you include the airwaves, they're just absolutely chock-a-block with opinion, with polemics, with you know, hyperbole. I mean, is there still a paucity of opinion when you factor in this whole teeming ocean of stuff that comes to Americans over the airwaves?
For sure. I don't maintain that the shout shows on television or the bloggers who are out there getting up there are that's what we ought to aspire to as a matter of journalism. When I talk about journals of opinion, I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about a mode of political discourse which is almost the opposite of that. So there, you know, there are, you asked before about the Nation's history a little bit, and there are two sentences in the Nation's history that say it all for me. One is the first sentence on the first page of the first issue of the first article of the magazine in 1865. And here's what it said. It said, and consider, ask yourself, would Tina Brown launch a new magazine with this sentence? Here's the sentence.
Okay.
The week was singularly barren of exciting events. Now, think about that. What that says is we are not going to be part of the phony hype and pretend that that everything we report has maximum importance. If nothing happened of interest that week, we're going to say so. The other sentence is the Nation, when it was born, it was funded by people in and around the abolitionist movement, inherited the subscription list of a magazine called The Liberator, which was an abolitionist magazine put out by William Lloyd Garrison. And his famous sentence was, I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, I will not retreat a single inch. And that was a statement of passion and deep commitment and crusading on behalf of the slaves who were, you know, held in, were being oppressed and were being treated as property, et cetera. Those two sentiments, at their best, it seems to me, interweave themselves, and they represent the journal of opinion at their best. The ability both not to be the handmaiden of some journalistic format that is imposed on you, whether by the marketplace, by your owners, or by the government, and yet the ability to be a crusading journal on behalf of what's right and to make that case for it in the public sphere.
Jack Beatty, here's Victor Nevesky, so many years at the helm fighting for this magazine, fighting to keep it alive. I mean, just every which way, finding the money, finding the readers finally. And saying we've got to keep these things going. Yet at the same time, there's a kind of an antique feeling about these in an age of blogs and all the shout fests on the radio, that little stapled paper that coming out every week. It's got an antique sort of a patina on it. Do you see it as vital to the American discourse?
Oh, I do, but I know exactly what you mean about that paper, and that's one of the things that sort of vouches for its purity, you know? I remember when the New Republic went to slick paper, I was a subscriber, and I thought, oh, my God, the flesh pots are here.
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Here it was. But, you know, it's a sort of, that's the way those things used to look, and the print would come
still
off.
Still does.
Yeah. And it's great. But I do think they have a tremendous role. Victor, here's what I think. I think that in a way, the opinion doesn't go high enough. Here's what I mean. The word capitalism, does that appear much in the nation? That is to say, as something up for discussion? I'm not aware that I see many people saying that this, talking about our whole world, really, and saying, is this the world we want? Talking about capitalism as a historical formation, talking about it as a as a system that has been created by human choice and can be changed by human choice. In short, a journal that would play the role that socialism used to play vis-a-vis capitalism. I don't see anybody really getting up that high.
Victor Nevesky, how about it? Have you been pulled down into the mud wrestle, too?
Okay. Here's what I have to say about that. You know, we're not a Marxist journal on the one hand. On the other hand, there is a debate that goes on in our pages that is very different from the arguments between the Democrats and the Republicans. And I would say there's more space between our socialist top-down planners and our bottom-up greens and anarchists and Luddites who have that argument in our pages. And we do revisit the socialist dream. Norman Rush, who's a great novelist, also is a very thoughtful social thinker, looked at all the old postulates of Marx, and he doesn't find them applicable today the way they used to be, although he still identifies with the dispossessed, the disenchanted. Another debate we have in our pages that you don't find between the Democrats and the Republicans, between the radical feminists who believe that pornography ought to be banned and the libertarians who believe that nothing should be banned, or debate between the human rights interventionists and the pacifists. These are fundamental questions of first principle. We argue them out, but we argue them out in tandem with what's going on that week. And so you get a very rare mix and blend of high theory, but actual application to actual problems that confront us day to day that are not identified as such in most of the media in this country, despite this proliferation of different outlets.
I guess if you want to look at the importance of journals like these days you've got to look kind of across the aisle. I mean, we've all seen in the Bush administration opinions that would show up in conservative opinion journals, in the National Review, in the Weekly Standard, appearing to be very closely related to executive power and policy. How does that make you feel, Victor? Are you still sticking up for them when they're driving the, you know, they've got the tiller and you don't?
Well, you know, I believe that Reagan came to power partly because of the Goldwater breakthrough in the Republican Party, and Goldwater's candidacy was made possible by the crazy ideas that were nourished in National Review for all those years, starting in 1956 when Bill Buckley founded it. Mm. And I don't take them as our model, but I think that they demonstrate the difference that a journal can make by not just putting new ideas on the national agenda, but by nourishing them and projecting them out there into the culture. And yes, we do fight for their right to their space. On the other hand, when I tried to call a conference some years ago at the University of Southern California, and I made a point to invite the editors and publishers of journals from across the political spectrum, in advance of the conference, we got attacked by our own columnist, Alex Colburn, for inviting all the journals of the right. At the conference, we got attacked by the journals of the right for among them, Hilton Kramer, who is a neoconservative editor of the New Criterion, for inviting people he didn't think worthy of his having a conversation with. And then we got attacked by the mainstream press because the conference didn't stay on point. So it showed the folly of trying to protect the space of those with whom you're in disagreement with. But I think it's a worthy enterprise.
Not easy to break bread across that chasm. Let's let our callers in here. Frank is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Frank. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, I just have a comment. I basically was always one of those right-wingers, I thought, until recently. I've actually listened to NPR for several years now. Being a truck driver, I have a lot of time to listen to the radio.
Yeah, I bet.
So the way way that I see it is listening to the right wing. They basically, you don't have opinions. You can't have a conversation with these people because they either shout you down or shut you up. It's like they're afraid to have any form of intellectual discussion with people. You know, and unfortunately, like the routes I run, I don't get to listen to a lot of liberal stuff, and I'm not by any means a liberal. I finally figured out that I'm a moderate.
Okay.
I'm a middle of the road kind of person, and I just find it really and it really angers me that they just don't get out the proper information to the American people any longer. It's just this big ideological fight between the right and the left, and the whole center seems like it's been dropped up along the wayside here to me.
Frank, we got it loud and clear. Keep those wheels on the road, and we're happy for your call. Victor Novasky.
Yeah, can I say something,
yes,
Frank? You know, we publish from time to time Jim Hightower, and Jim Hightower agrees with you. It's not right and left. It's top-bottom.
And this is the Texan,
railroad commissioner.
Railroad commissioner from Texas.
Agriculture.
Agriculture, that's
right. Yeah, and he's an old-fashioned populist.
Mm-hmm.
But again, he's the guy who got up and made the speech that George Bush was born with a silver. Well, actually, it was Ann Richards born with a silver
right,
foot.
Right.
But you know, he says there's nothing in the middle of the road but yellow streaks and dead armadillos. So he's an argument against the middle of the road. On the other hand, he sees the real divide between those with the wealth, that 1% that has all of the wealth in this country, and the many more who are on bottom.
And what about the right-wing radio that Frank listened to for many years when he was driving his truck? Do you see it as an extension of those same opinion journals on the right? Is it the natural outgrowth of William Buckley's work at the National Review and the rest, or is this a new breed of animal here?
Well, I think there are three or four things going on. Number one is, yes, these journals put out ideas out there and they are recirculated and have a new life out there. They're simplified. They're put out there on talk radio. You know, there's a fellow named Jeffrey Scheuer who wrote a book called The Soundbite Society where he makes an argument that I don't agree with, but it's worth thinking about. And he argues that the reason you have all this talk radio on the right is that their ideas are simple ones, and they're reducible to sound bites, whereas the arguments on the left are a little more complicated, and so they don't lend themselves to that kind of expression. But alongside of that, you do have this new concentration in media, and the money is there. So it's the combination of the concentration and the money that projects this stuff out there. But there have been the beginnings of rumblings about that. For example, this media reform movement mobilized a lot of folks who wrote their congresspeople to object to the attempt to lift the caps on the number of different media outlets that the same company could own, and the FCC was going to have new rules, and they had to withdraw that plan because of the protests of hundreds of thousands of citizens. So maybe something is happening out there.
Victor, let me ask you, you know, the old saying, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? If the ideas between the covers of The Nation are so potent and so oriented toward truth, as you describe them, why aren't they the governing ideas of this country?
Well, someone once said of The Nation that it was a magazine for the permanent minority. And at first I sort of resented that because it sounded like what you're talking about. But then I thought about it and I said, hey, just a minute. Abolition, that was one of the first ideas of this magazine. Integration, that was one of the second ideas of this magazine. All of the reforms of the New Deal, Social Security and all that. Okay, there's an attempt to dismantle Social Security. But the fact is that an international perspective. All of these things have come to pass, so that it's not that it hasn't come to power. It's that the magazine has consistently, for many years, been ahead of its time. Now, this week is not its time, but it does put these ideas on the agenda, and it is sort of a holding action for the times when it really matters. So, for example, in the run-up to the Iraq War, The Nation was raising, as were other journals, all kinds of questions that were not really being debated in the mainstream media, not just about weapons of mass destruction, but about what would happen afterwards. And all of the things that have come to pass were things that were anticipated in these journals. Now, you know, your guess is as good as mine as to why national policy hadn't caught up, hasn't yet caught up with those very critical questions. But I think our society, our democracy depends on folks being out there and having a forum to raise those questions.
Jack Beattie, how about it? Victor Noveski wants to kind of declare victory even as Bush marches into his second term. Yeah. Fair?
Well, you know, there's that saying of Simone Weil's, justice is a fugitive from the camp of victory. And that's always the case, isn't it? Somebody's left out. And, you know, the Nation and the New Republic kept alive the torch of progressivism through the 1920s, which judged by, even by our standards, well, leave out international policy, but was as conservative as you got. And the ideas of the New Deal were there. They had worked them out. They had had the arguments. Brandeis, Frankfurt, all of them. And it was there when the time came.
Victor Noveski's new memoir is A Matter of Opinion. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? What's your take on opinion journals of the right and left today? Are they redundant with the high political attitude of so much of the media? Are they necessary? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Victor Noveski, publisher of The Nation, about dissent, debate, and opinion in American journalism today, his new memoir. And it is quite a book. It is A Matter of Opinion. He joins us tonight from New York. Jack Beattie is with us as well. You can join us. Where do you turn for important ideas, for depth, for truth? And if The Nation's liberal outlook is so darn smart, why hasn't it won? Why hasn't it carried the day? If challenging voices are important to you, do you recognize the importance of journals on the right and the left? What's the state of The Nation's conversation with itself? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Victor, you've got terrific stories in here about the hoops you've jumped through to keep this journal alive over the years. Give us a sense of just how hard it is to maintain a voice of dissent coming out every week in the American political and financial climate.
Well, you know, let's see. I don't know where to start. One thing is, when I got there, the magazine was losing a fair amount of money every year. And when I became publisher, it was losing $500,000 a year. So I had to go out and both raise the money to pay the previous publisher for the magazine, for the right to own a magazine that lost $500,000 a year. I had to explain that to my wife as well.
Right.
And then I had to raise money to not just cover the losses, but to invest in the magazine, to grow it to the point where it could pay its own way. And that's where folks like Paul Newman became very helpful to us. And but then you have to go, and I ended up testifying before the Post Office Postal Rate Commission, because the Magazine Publishers Association, which one would have thought represented the interests of all magazines, turned out to represent the interest of the larger magazines and were approving a postal rate formula that would have penalized magazines like the New Republic and the Weekly Standard or the National Review and the Nation because we can't do the kinds of bulk mailings that they were ready to give discounted mailing rates for. So all of those things press in on you, and that is part of the joy, though, of being there and the great struggle.
But it hardly ever makes a profit. Three times in the 50-year history of the paper, and people can't agree on what 3 years those were. It always depends on the kindness of rich patrons, one way or another.
Well, no, it's not just the kindness of rich patrons, because the magazine is subsidized by its writers, who are not rich for the most part. For example, you know, our house humorist, Calvin Trillin, is always making jokes about how we pay in the high two figures. Of course, my response to Bud Trillin is, we actually told him we were thinking of paying in the high two figures. We paid him $100 for his column, not a penny more, a penny less. And then, about 10 years ago, he said he's stopping doing his column. He's going to write a weekly poem. And I said, okay, Bud, we'll keep paying you $100 for your poem. And then one week, he had the nerve to turn in a three-word poem, which makes him the highest-paid poet in America. And then I remember the poem, right. By the way. The poem was on the O.J. Simpson case, and the poem was O.J. Oy vey. So the fact is that we are subsidized by our writers. We are subsidized by our editors, who could be making a lot more money working across the street for major media. And yes, by our rich patrons, but also we have a circle of 100 small shareholders who are former school teachers, who are civil servants, who are subscribers, for whom The Nation is a lifeline. And they are a non-geographical community that for whom this magazine is critical, because the local press doesn't cover the issues they're interested in, and the national press they don't trust. And so it's not just wealthy people, it's people across the board.
You've got the story of Gore Vidal, what Penthouse was trying to get him to write something, and I think asked you what he might charge, wondering if they could afford him.
Well, we had run an issue on the occasion of our 120th anniversary, and Vidal had written an article which caused a great stir on the question of empire, and it had made national news. And Guccione invited me up to his penthouse, and he's serving $100 wines, and he says to me, you know, what did you pay Gore Vidal for that piece? I said, we paid him the same thing we paid everybody else, $25. We invited people from around the globe to give their views on how the image of America had changed in the last 25 years. And at that point, he looked at me, he's sputtering over his $100 glass of wine, and said, you know, that he had offered him something like $50,000 to write an article for Penthouse.
Ouch.
And Vidal had declined the honor. And then he said he was thinking of buying The Nation. And, of course, The Nation was not for sale, as it happened. But had he bought The Nation, had it been for sale, Gore Vidal would never have written for him for $25, because not because he had a lot of money, but because of what you know, Penthouse stood for and what The Nation stands for.
Of course, that centerfold would bump up your postal rates as well, I suppose. Sean is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Sean. We're on the air. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Excuse me if I stumble over my words.
Not at all. I do it myself.
I was a long-time Nation subscriber, and I frankly canceled my subscription after you endorsed Kerry for the presidency, and I should have done it when you wrote in your editorial pages that you didn't want Ralph Nader to run. Frankly, the call to silence a voice of political discourse of a man who's published in your magazine many, many times, frankly, disgusts me. And I just wondered, what your reaction to that was. I really feel like the magazine has just become this Democratic Party planning machine, licking its wounds, really kind of pathetic.
And you want something more strident, more, what do you want, Sean?
Well, I mean, listen, in my mind, both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are lying to us constantly, every day. The hypocrisy is so deep now that, you couldn't shovel it out with a backhoe. And the only time that the Nation even, one issue that I'm really concerned about is the 9/11 Truth Movement, and the Nation hasn't said anything about it. I canceled my subscription to the Nation and got a subscription to Harper's because they did come out and say the 9/11 Commission report is a whitewash, and that's what it is. And the only time the Nation even discussed that was in these pathetic articles by David Korn, who was coming out against another investigative journalist who was doing great work, one Michael Rupert. And so I just wondered, what Victor thought.
Yeah, we've got it, Sean. We've got it. We thank you for your call. Victor Novasky, you must have taken tens of thousands of brickbats over the years. Put this one in Sean's in that context, and please respond directly to what Sean's asking.
Let me start with Nader, and I'm going to start with the election before the last one, where the Nation had a lot of editors who supported Ralph Nader and writers, but nevertheless, again, editorially, we did come out in favor of voting to prevent Bush from coming to power because we feared he might do a whole set of things which would be destructive to the Republic. Now, he got us in this war in Iraq. And you can argue that Al Gore would have done the same thing. I don't believe that, but maybe he would have. The question is whether the Nader strategy is the best is best applied at the national election level. I happen to believe that the old New Party, which had this idea of challenging the major parties from the bottom up and doing it in local elections and then building and transforming through that kind of strategy is a better one because inevitably third-party candidates seem to end up playing a spoiler role. Having said that, I have the greatest respect for Ralph Nader. As you pointed out, he's not only has published many articles in the magazine, he published his first article in The Nation. I knew him when he was in law school, and he was writing about unsafe automobiles. The Nation gave him a forum. We still give Ralph a forum. He is much friendlier towards the magazine than you are. I don't accept your description of what's in it. I do take your word that you've canceled your subscription. That's why you don't know what we're doing every week. It is true that we did assign David Korn to look into this whole business of the last election, and he doesn't agree with you in terms of what he found, but he's not the only voice we have in this magazine.
But what about the
it is
the
a
larger,
constant It is a constant. We are a forum for the debate between the radicals and the liberals, and that's not true of many journals in this country.
So the charge Sean raises that you become a kind of house organ for the Democratic Party.
Well, you can't tell that to Alex Coburn, who writes a column for us every other week. Tell that to Patricia Williams, who writes a column for us every other week criticizing the Democratic Party. Tell that to Katha Pollitt, who writes a column for us every other week criticizing the Democratic Party. And also, you know, we're saying nothing, by the way, about our arts coverage, which I consider the best in the country. Arthur Danto is a wholly original voice writing about the end of beauty and issues that are just over the horizon and that give a richness to the context of the political discussion and show that it's part of a larger cultural formation and that you can't think of one without understanding the other.
It does. It does. Mira is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Mira. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I was listening to that former caller, and I wanted to say that I do feel I was a Democrat, and I read The Nation all the time. I read The Nation even when I don't have time to read The Nation. And it made an independent out of me.
Because it's...
because it has such a... It has constantly conflicting viewpoints. I, frankly, Alexander Coburn sets my teeth on edge. But sometimes he says, has some really good stuff, like the latest issue. He had a piece on Galloway, you know, who came to speak to Congress. Mm. And it was so...
British MP.
It was delightful. It was, you know, hilarious. And I also just want to add one other thing.
Yes.
I do want to say I think that the arts, literary coverage of history is terrific. It is, that interests me enormously. And it's one of the things, if this were just political, and I'm a very political person, I mean, there are a couple of other magazines I might turn to, but this magazine is so whole and so complete. I just finished reading in the last issue a piece by Terry Eagleton on Picture Imperfect, Utopian Thought for an Anti-Utopian
right,
Age.
Now,
this is the first place I've ever seen something I've thought about for a long time, which is how much of the thought of the 20th century influenced by Jewish thinkers really does somehow go back to the Mosaic idea of God. And that's explored in that article.
The kind of risks of utopian thinking. We're nearly out of time here. Victor Nevesky, I'm looking here at the latest circulation figures. New Republic, 62,000. The National Review, 150,000. The Nation, 175,000. In your league, you're riding high.
Yeah, we have the largest circulation of any opinion journal in the country right now. And that's true. We don't judge, or I don't judge, the influence of these journals by the numbers of their readers. You judge it by the quality of your readership. And we have two kinds of readers. One, the classic reader of these journals, who are people who are interested in ideas. They're teachers, they're people, they're journalists, they're people involved in the public sector. And then we have movement activists. And they're both, and they're very different kinds of folks with different agendas, different attitudes, and different politics. And we speak to both of them, and they speak to each other through the magazine.
Jack, a final thought on The Nation with Victor Nevesky here tonight. We've just got a minute.
Oh, well, I wanted to come back to that arts coverage. I mean, just historically, I remember Diana Trilling's essays that I read books of in the 40s. She was reviewing novels. Your film critic, Stuart Clowens, actually has a social conscience and wit. And that's another thing. Victor, you were an editor, as I remember, of Monocle, a satiric magazine. And don't you think we could do with a little more of that Victor Nevesky light touch in The Nation and maybe even in The Atlantic and just generally? I mean, why should the right have all the wit?
I'll start signing my articles.
Good. Yeah.
If we do have a few seconds, I just want to come back to this Democratic question. I plead guilty. We have Democratic readers. One day I came back to my office and I found this message on my phone, which I print in the book, from a woman who said, I need to ask a favor of you. I'm stuck in Abbeville, Louisiana, and I want to move, but I want to move somewhere where I can see a Democrat before I die. It occurs to me that you might might be able to rummage up a place where people are actually subscribers to The Nation, where I could have somebody to talk to.
This is a next address.
This is what the magazine means to our readers.
Victor Novesky, with that, we're out of time. It's been great having you. Victor Novesky, author of the new memoir, A Matter of Opinion. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, both of you.
Jack, great to have you as well.
Thank you.
In a moment, making the case for blue-collar work. This is On Point. It's an annual rite of spring. Across the country, teens are graduating from high school, many with dreams of heading to college and landing a high-paying white-collar job someday. But Massachusetts resident Joe LaMaccia wants teenagers to reconsider that dream. He's pushing the virtues of blue-collar work. LaMaccia never went to college. He never sat in a cubicle. Today, he owns a $2 million construction company. Joe LaMaccia has started a website called Blue Collar and Proud of It. It's a clearinghouse for information on blue-collar jobs. In this radio diary, Joe LaMaccia makes the case for blue-collar work.
Between running my own construction company here in eastern Massachusetts, I was finding when I would run an ad, I couldn't get a truck driver or a mason or a skilled worker to, you know, even call back to apply for the job. And at the same time, I'd be going to the school meetings. I have five children. And I could feel the push that most of them had to go to college, and the internet and the information age and maybe a liberal arts degree, et cetera, et cetera. I started to see that there was a deficit here in hiring and supply and demand. There's necessary jobs out there, jobs that don't get outsourced, jobs that you can move anywhere in the world if you're an electrician, a plumber, a carpenter, an auto mechanic. And they're great jobs. You don't live out of a suitcase. You're not going to the airport. You're home for the Little League games with the kids. I was a young guy, married early, and I was working three jobs, and I was going nowhere. I saw a friend of mine was in a landscaping business. I didn't think he was running it very well, and I said, hell, I can give this a shot. I really just copied the winners, the big signs on the trucks. I answered my calls. A lot of trial and error, believe me. It wasn't a smooth thing. It's been a fantastic life. The phone just keeps ringing. You're in demand. I just wanted to pass the word. They say the kids are graduating today from the Volk schools have three jobs waiting for them. It's a big supply and demand problem, and maybe eventually in 20 years it'll flip back, but there's a lot of jobs out there. College is a great thing. You want to be like it was years ago. You want to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer or a scientist, you know, but to just go into school, these kids are going in for these liberal arts degrees, and they parents are pulling these equity loans, and the kids either drop out or quit in 18 months, and then they come work for me. They're driving asphalt trucks, and they're happy as could be. I'd say 40 to 70 grand for the average person that wants to go into the trade. I have bricklayers working for me making 50 to 60,000, and that's only 10 months' work. You want to go in your own business, I mean, the sky's the limit. Guys are telling me they're doing 50 to 70,000 a year in the garages, in the auto mechanics. I think it's a great life. It's a good job. You dig up a driveway in the morning, and if you pave an asphalt and it's done in the afternoon, it's instant. It's really nice for this day and age.
Joe LaMaccia owns a construction company in Newton, Massachusetts. To learn more about his Blue Collar and Proud of It project, visit our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.